Gathered in the West Ballroom of the Shoreham Hotel this evening to celebrate the third anniversary of the Social Security Act are some 450 members of the staff of the Social Security Board and other agencies administering this nationwide program. President Roosevelt signed this law on August 14, 1935, shortly after it had received one of the largest congressional approval votes on record. Seated at the speaker's table are 25 guests, men and women who have had a particular part in bringing this law into being and administering it. The principal address will be delivered by President Roosevelt, who will in a few moments speak from the White House. The Executive Director of the Social Security Board, Mr. Frank Bain, is Toastmaster for the occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bain.
In the nomenclature of America for many years, social legislation and Robert F. Wagner have been synonymous terms. Ladies and gentlemen, the Senator from New York. My friends, I am honored to present Franklin D. Roosevelt, the President of the United States.
You, my friends, in every walk of life and in every part of the nation, who are active believers in Social Security. The Social Security Act is 3 years old today. This is a good vantage point from which to take a long look backward to its beginnings, to cast an appraising eye over what it has accomplished so far, and to survey its possibilities of future growth. 5 years ago, the term Social Security was new to most American ears. Today, it has significance for more than 40 million men and women workers. Nearly a third of our whole population, workers whose applications for old age insurance accounts have been received. This system is designed to assure them an income for life after old age retires them from their jobs. It has significance for more than 27.5 million men and women wage earners who have earned credits under state unemployment insurance laws, which provide half wages to help bridge the gap between jobs. It has significance for the needy men, women, and children receiving assistance and for their families, at least 2,300,000 all told. With this cash assistance, 1,700,000 old folks are spending their last years in surroundings they know and with people they love. More than 600,000 dependent children are being taken care of, and about 40,000 blind people are assured of peace and security among familiar voices. Yes, it has significance for the families and communities to whom expanded public health and child welfare services have brought added protection, and it has significance for all of us who as citizens have at heart the security and the well-being of this great democracy. These accomplishments of 3 years are impressive, and yet we should not be unduly proud of them. Our government, in fulfilling an obvious obligation to the citizens of the country, has been doing so only because the citizens require action from their representatives. If the people during these years had chosen a reactionary administration or a do-nothing Congress, Social Security would still be in the conversational stage, a beautiful dream that might come true in the dim, distant future. But the underlying desire for personal and family security, even 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, was nothing new. In the early days of colonization and through the long years that followed, the worker, the farmer, the merchant, the man of property, the preacher and the idealist came here to build each for himself a stronghold for the things that he loved. The stronghold was his home. The things he loved and wished to protect were his family, his material, and his spiritual possessions. His security, then as now, was bound up with that of his friends and his neighbors. But as the nation has developed, as invention and industry and commerce have grown more complex, the hazards of life have become more complex. Among an increasing host of fellow citizens, among the often intangible forces of giant industry, man has discovered that his individual strength and wits were no longer enough. This is true not only of the worker at the shop bench or at the ledger, it was true also of the merchant or the manufacturer who employed him. Where heretofore men had turned to their neighbors for help and advice, they now turned to a wider neighborhood. In other words, to their government. Now this is interesting to consider. The first to turn to government, the first to receive protection from government, were not the poor and the lowly, those who had no resources other than their daily earnings, but they were the rich and the strong. Beginning in the 19th century, a whole century ago, the United States began passing protective laws, designed in the main to give security to property owners, to industrialists, to merchants, and to bankers. True, the little man often profited by this type of legislation, but that was a byproduct rather than a motive. Taking a generous view of the situation, I think it was not that government deliberately ignored the working man in those days, but that the working man was not sufficiently articulate to make his needs and his problems known. The powerful in industry and commerce had powerful voices, both individually and as a group. And whenever they saw their possessions threatened, they raised their voices in appeals for government protection. It was not until workers became more articulate through organization that protective labor legislation was passed. While such laws raised the standards of life, they still gave no assurance of economic security. Strength or skill of arm or skill of brain did not guarantee a man a job. It did not guarantee him a roof. It did not guarantee him the ability to provide for those dependent upon him, or to take care of himself when he was too old to work. Long before the economic blight of the Depression descended on the nation, millions of our people were living in waste lands of want and fear. Long before 1929, men and women too old and infirm to work either depended on those who had but little to share or spent their remaining years within the walls of a poorhouse. Fatherless children early learned the meaning of being a burden to relatives or to the community. Men and women still strong, still young, but discarded as gainful workers, were drained of self-confidence and self-respect. The millions of today want and have a right to the same security that their forefathers sought. The assurance that with health and the willingness to work, they will find a place for themselves in the social and economic system of the time. And because it has become increasingly difficult for individuals to build their own security single-handed, government must now step in and help them lay the foundation stones, just as government in the past has helped lay the foundation of business and industry. We must face the fact that in this country we have a rich man's security and a poor man's security, and that the government owes equal obligations to both. National security is not a half and half matter. It is all or none. The Social Security Act offers to all our citizens a working method of meeting urgent present needs and of forestalling future needs. It utilizes the familiar machinery of our federal state government system to promote the common welfare and the common stability of the whole nation. The Act does not offer anyone, either individually or collectively, an easy life, nor was it ever intended so to do. None of the sums of money paid out to individuals in assistance or insurance will spell anything approaching abundance, but they will furnish that minimum necessary to keep a foothold, and that is the kind of protection Americans want. What we are doing is good, but it is not good enough. To be truly national, a Social Security program must include all those who need its protection. Today, many of our citizens are still excluded from old age insurance and unemployment compensation because of the nature of their employment. This must be set aright, and it will be. Some time ago, I directed the Social Security Board to give attention to the development of a plan for liberalizing and extending the old age insurance system to provide benefits for wives and widows and orphans. More recently, a great national health conference has been held at my suggestion to consider ways and means of extending to the people of this country more adequate health and medical services, and also to afford the people of this country some protection against the economic losses arising out of ill health. I am hopeful that on the basis of studies and investigations now underway, the Congress will improve and extend the law. I am also confident that each year will bring further development in federal and state Social Security legislation, and that is as it should be. One word of warning, however. In our efforts to provide security for all of the American people, let us not allow ourselves to be misled by those who advocate shortcuts to utopia or fantastic financial schemes. We have come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. There is still today a frontier that remains unconquered, an America unreclaimed. This is the great and nationwide frontier of insecurity, of human want and human fear. This is the frontier, the America, that we have set ourselves to reclaim. This third anniversary would not be complete if I did not express the gratitude of the nation to those splendid citizens who so greatly helped me in making Social Security legislation possible, and to those patriotic men and women, both employers and employees, who in their daily activities are today making Social Security work. First of all, to the first woman who has ever sat in the Cabinet of the United States, Miss Frances Perkins, then and now the Secretary of Labor. Then to the unselfish commission of men and women who 4 years ago, in 1934, devoted themselves to the almost superhuman task of studying all manner of American problems, of examining legislation already attempted in other nations, and of coordinating the whole into practical recommendations for legislative action. Finally, I thank publicly, as I have so often thanked them privately, four men who have had long and distinguished careers in the public service. Congressman David J. Lewis of Maryland, who is known as one of the American pioneers in the cause of Social Security. Senator Robert F. Wagner of New York, who also has long been its advocate. Senator Harrison of Mississippi and Congressman Doughton of North Carolina, who carried the bill successfully through the Senate and the House of Representatives 3 years ago. They deserve, and they have, the gratitude of us all for this service to mankind.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking from the White House in Washington on the occasion of the third anniversary of the enactment of the Social Security law.